Well, I'm grateful to hear that. I've had some wonderful musical experiences here. I'm pretty thrilled with all that we have achieved together. We have one season left, and I'm planning on making it the best that we possibly can, and to end with a bang. It's time for me to pursue other things.
Is there such a thing as a career arc for a music director, a conductor? And if so, what is it?
It's different from each individual. Some people shoot straight to the top and their arc is rather a flat line, but it's at the top. Others work their way slowly there. I think what it really is for the individual to be true to themselves. That's the true arc, and to see where that takes you.
How have you grown over your 3 years and heading into your fourth?
Oh, I've grown unbelievably. My first ever job as music director. I have a lot of guest conducting experience. I've loved everything I've had to do with the community involvement, and to have grown with the orchestra itself, to have hired about 30 people, to see a real artistic change in how we play, and I'm so proud of what we've achieved.
How would you define that shift in the atmosphere of the orchestra?
We've just gone from strength to strength. I've been demanding as a music director for levels of excellence. I feel people have risen. I feel the new hires we've had have brought new energy and increased excitement to our music making. And this leaps across the floodlights to the audience.
Resounding Russians is the title for the first concert of the season. You open with Glinka's Ruslan and Ludmila Overture. Tell us the story.
The story. Well, there's a hero called Ruslan and a heroine called Ludmila. Ludmila gets captured by an evil dwarf god called Chernobog, and ultimately Ruslan wins her back. It's a classic tale and one of the most innovative things. This was 1842 that this was written, so quite early. Glinka was the father of Russian music. One of the favorite things that you hear in the overture is the dwarf god is symbolized by a whole tone descending scale. This was radical back then. Schoenberg, I'm sure, would have been very, very proud, as would have Debussy 100 years later or so. And if just inspired all the Russian composers to come, where would they have been without Glinka?
The solo is with Alexander Taradze. He is a specialist in this particular work, Prokofiev's Third Piano Concerto. What does his critically acclaimed interpretation do that others don't for this Prokofiev standard?
He has won great acclaim for how he's approached it, and some of the technical difficulties that, especially near the end of the first movement, are beyond most pianists. He has very huge, very strong hands. He's lived with this piece for many decades. He teaches at South Bend University in Indiana. And I first met him when he was playing this piece with the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, where I was the assistant conductor, in 1999. And he blew me away then. We've met a couple of times since in airports, and last time was in Rio at the hotel. I was finishing up a week with the orchestra, and he was about to start a week with the orchestra. And I've never worked with him, so I can't wait to fully appreciate what he brings to the piece. He has several recordings out, and his recording of all five piano concertos, Prokofiev piano concertos, with Gergiev and the Kirov Orchestra have been critically acclaimed and have been described by many as the best example of all five together, especially the third one. And this has been hailed by critics all over.
He also makes a ritual of prayer before performances. Mm-hmm. How important is a pre-performance ritual, whether it's prayer or meditation or some other sort of centering exercise to getting the best out of yourself when you go on stage?
That, of course, depends on the individual. I know that many musicians have a quiet moment before they go on stage. We all have faith of different levels, I think, and whatever it takes. For example, my sister in the Berlin Philharmonic, one of her rituals is to always eat a banana before she goes on stage because it has just the right energy and will fill her up and she won't get hungry on stage, etc. And I know many other musicians like to focus on how music is bigger than all of us yet brings us together. I think bowing before the bigness of music is very important. Music is bigger than us, and I think it's recognizing that which helps us to really know our place in the performance of music and how to serve it best.
Big symphonic work is Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 4. Proof, if any, were ever needed that a crummy family life can sometimes result in great art. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. Well, in one level, you can see the Fourth Symphony as how Tchaikovsky composed himself out of his personal crisis, which, of course, was his homosexuality, which back then was, of course, wrong, forbidden, not allowed, and everything he couldn't say with words, he said in music. He tried everything. We know his diaries are full of how he struggled with this, and he tried everything, even marriage to a woman, and that failed. And it was right after that he wrote this symphony to express what he couldn't in other ways.
It didn't get a great reception. His friends, Taneyev and Rubinstein, were saying, yeah, it was well played, it went okay. And the critics in a couple different cities weren't all that happy with it. They were referring to it as somewhat barbaric. The composer's twaddle disturbed my mood. The confusion in brass and the abuse of the kettle drums drove me away. Why is it still a standard? What changed after that initial reception?
Tchaikovsky's greatest gifts was melody, and some of the melodies in here just grab you and don't leave you, and his way to orchestrate those go straight to the heart. That's a general description of all of Tchaikovsky's music, but so pertinent to this symphony here, full of great melodies. And the more we know about Tchaikovsky, perhaps Taneyev and these people didn't know so much of his struggles back then, but to know what he was searching for, he even described the opening motif as fate itself. But the fate of what? The fate of mankind. He wrote a short synopsis, which he sent to his patroness, Nadia von Meck, so we know a little bit about his thoughts as to what he was trying to describe. And at the end of the symphony, you know, we're left with a question, well, did he solve it? And if we'd listened to the piece in context, we wouldn't kind of know. Maybe he did. It's a rejoicing kind of an ending, or is it? Does he leave with questions? Well, we know there are questions because he wrote two more symphonies later, Symphony 5 and 6, which also deal with his own personal fate and then his own personal demise in the 6th symphony. So to put the three symphonies together, 4, 5, and 6, is a very powerful thing. And each one stands so beautifully on their own, but the beginning of them was Symphony No. 4. We performed Symphony No. 5 a few years ago. It has famous melodies as well. But really to have your first explosions in music as to what can I do with my life. The opening fanfare, even if you don't know anything about music, you can still, as in the audience, feel the tension, feel the unrest, feel the writhing that goes on in the melodies, in the musical language that he uses. And it's a most incredible journey I don't think I'll ever tire of listening to or conducting.
Alistair Willis is the music director of the Illinois Symphony Orchestra. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.